Word of mouth.
Just a lonely, lonely Christmas.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. The holidays are a time for gathering with friends and family. For dudes, not so much. A study published by the American Sociological Review found that white, heterosexual men have the fewest friends of any American demographic, which may be why the bromance movies like I Love You, Man hit so close to home.
Hooking up is easy. Meeting platonic male friends, not so much.
So what do I do? I mean, how do I meet friends? It's such a weird concept.
Well, I can do some recon around the gym. But you're gonna have to be aggressive about this, man.
Yeah.
Use the internet to meet guys. Get mom to fix you up. I mean, if you see a cool-looking guy, strike up a conversation and ask him on a mandate.
Lisa Wade is Associate Professor of Sociology at Occidental College and Principal Writer for Sociological Images. She wrote about the American man's friend crisis for Salon. Lisa, great to have you with us.
I'm happy to be here.
Men need more friends. I mean, that sounds like a chapter straight out of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. This is still true?
I know. And when I first started looking into this research, I thought, surely this is too stereotypical to be right. But it turns out it is true. I mean, first of all, we all need more friends, especially as adults. But white heterosexual men in particular, they do. They report fewer close, intimate friendships involving self-disclosure than women do.
What if having fewer, less intimate friends is what men want? Are these companionship shortcomings being unfairly measured through a female lens?
Right. Well, researchers considered that. Are we measuring male friendships with a female yardstick? And so they asked men, what kind of friendships do you want? Do you want what we call shoulder-to-shoulder friendships, where you do a lot of activities together? Or do you want some face-to-face time, too, where you actually talk about your feelings and what's going on in your life? And men actually report wanting that type of face-to-face interaction, as well as the shoulder-to-shoulder. So it doesn't appear that we're measuring it with a female yardstick. And furthermore, if you ask men, what do you mean by intimacy, when you say you want intimacy in your friendships, they'll say the same thing that women do. So they want self-disclosure.
The study finds that white heterosexual adult men have fewer friends. So what about boys?
Boys tend to be excellent friends. Research on middle school and elementary school boys show that they are just as likely as girls of the same age to be incredibly loving towards their friends, to be intimate with them, to share with them how they feel about each other. And in fact, one study by Niobe Way, she interviewed men in every year of high school, same kid as he kind of grew up. And the young boys were just incredibly articulate about their friendships. One had this really touching part where he said that he thought of his best friend like a grown-up version of a teddy bear.
Hmm. When does that start to shift?
It shifts over the course of high school as boys start to try to sort of do their man projects, right? They're trying to grow up into men. They're trying to figure out what it means to be a man. And as they do that, they tend to push friends away and start to redefine themselves as someone who doesn't need friends.
Any ideas why it is heterosexual white men in particular that have trouble being intimate?
Well, intimacy in our society is feminized, and so one of the reasons that some men start to push away intimacy with other people, including other adult men, is because they are taught in no uncertain terms in our society that they should avoid feminine things. And this is especially true for young men who are still unsure about whether or not they can kind of pull off adult masculinity. And so white heterosexual men tend to be at the top of a male hierarchy, and so they have the most invested in preserving the idea of a real man because they are more likely to benefit from it.
Mm-hmm.
It might also be that men of color are bonding in other ways. So they're bonding, for example, over the experience of prejudice, and that brings them together in a way.
The term bromance is jokingly used to describe close male friendships. We think of, you know, the whole Judd Apatow kind of movie genre, the Ben Affleck and Matt Damon or George Clooney and Brad Pitt. But there are some real implications for having few male friendships. Is this something that we should be concerned about?
Oh, absolutely, we should be concerned about it. I mean, first of all, it's part of a wider problem with sexism, right? We think about sexism as being prejudice against women, but that's actually been going down over the last 50 years. Whereas prejudice against femininity, everything associated with women, that's a different kind of sexism, and it's actually been on the rise over the last 50 years. So the fact that men are trying to avoid femininity as part of a masculinity project is a problem in our society in general around sexism. But moreover, for individual men, they really do want friends. So in a society that denigrates femininity, where men are trying to avoid it, they end up avoiding all the things associated with women, and their lives get narrower and narrower. And so that's sad for men. And they need friends as well. Friends are wonderful. I mean, they're as good for you as not smoking or maintaining a healthy weight. They're incredibly good for your physical health and for your mental health as well. As you're aging, for example, having a good friend is much more predictive of your happiness than even having grandchildren.
Any advice for our male listeners to overcome these difficulties and reap the benefits of more close friendships?
Well, sure. Guys out there, if you're one of those guys that would like more guy friends, there's lots of other guys that feel that way too. And it's going to be scary to try to initiate disclosure with your male friends. And that is something you just have to accept. So you have to be strong about that. And your guy friends may not be very good friends right off the bat in that sense. And so sometimes you have to teach them how to be good friends because they haven't had role models or they haven't had a lot of practice. So it's a challenging project, but it's one with a lot of rewards and one that I suspect you have lots of men in your life who'd be happy to hear from you.
Lessons for Bros from Lisa Wade. Thank you.
I'm glad to be here.
Lisa Wade, Associate Professor of Sociology at Occidental College and Principal Writer for Sociological Images. You can find a link to read her Salon.com review of the study identifying white heterosexual men as having few friends. There's a link at wordaboutradio.org. McGregor Memorial EMS, a nonprofit organization, has been delivering emergency medical services to Durham, Lee, Madbury, and UNH since 1968. In this season of generosity, we're looking at people who give of themselves all year round. Today, volunteer first responders.
I'm Bill Cody. I'm the executive director for McGregor Memorial EMS. We're proudly celebrating our 45th year of continuous EMS service to Durham, Lee, Madbury, and the University of New Hampshire. We have 6 paid staff people, and we have a roster of 70 volunteers. We're going to go over 2,000 responses this year, and we are incredibly busy.
I'm Adam Raphael. I'm 22 years old. I am a fifth-year senior, and I've been a member here since fall of 2011. The first time, you know, I walked through the ER doors, my world changed because just the amount of focus that was going on through the doctors and all the other EMS people that were bringing patients in, it connected bridges for me and it made it all worth it. I think the medical aspect of it for me is just being in a situation where you walk in a room and someone who's in their worst moment looks at you for help.
My name's Chris Lumlin. I became a volunteer with McGregor in 2001 when I was a UNH student. I'm 31 years old now, but I've never quite been able to leave McGregor. It's just kind of held me here.
Tone test for McGregor EMS.
One of the coolest things about EMS is that you never quite know where you're going to end up. And so I can be in some of the nicest houses in New Hampshire in one moment and then be in a college dormitory the next moment and be somewhere completely else, you know, later on that day. And so it's a lot of fun because you do get to have that full range of society and interact and help all sorts of different people.
Hello, my name is Stephanie Lane, 35 years old. Well, no, I'll be 35 in March, so not yet, but soon. I actually, for quite a while, worked at McDonald's. I just had a career there. I worked there for 16 years. I actually still currently work there part-time. And then I finally decided that it was time to pursue my interest in the medical field. So I was like, well, go be an EMT. That sounds like that'd be a cool thing to do, volunteer. And then I got my EMT basic license 3 years ago and really liked it. So I continued to volunteer here at McGregor and then the next thing I know, I was like, oh, this is really nice. I'm going to go to paramedic school. So I'm actually currently just finished my first semester of paramedic school. And hopefully in 2 years, I'll have my paramedic license and I'll be able to do this full time.
A tone test only. I'll be on duty, babe.
I think that this is one of the most meaningful things that most people are ever going to do. It really is an opportunity to touch people and members of our community at a time when they really need help, and that's truly an honor. I think the other thing is that the community within McGregor, the people that we work with, and I would include that to the area fire departments and police departments, and are just, everyone's heart is in the right place. Everyone is in it for the same mission, and people just do a terrific job of pulling that mission off.
There's more word of mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
All I want for Christmas
is... From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're listening to All I Want for Christmas Is You by Mariah Carey. The song, released in 1994, has become a sort of Christmas standard, consistently topping the Billboard holiday charts. Despite the sleigh load of holiday albums released each winter, there has not been an original holiday single with the staying power of Mariah Carey's hit for 19 years. So has our culture stopped welcoming new holiday songs? Has our Christmas carol quota been met? Chris Klimek is here to weigh in. His article for Slate, All I Want for Christmas is a New Christmas Song, pretty much says it all. Chris, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
Why has Mariah Carey's song stood the test of time while others fail to catch on?
You know, I think it has kind of a timeless quality, or at least, you know, it sounds like it falls somewhere within, like, the last half century of pop music, but it's got a little bit of that you know, Phil Spector kind of sound from the early 60s, but a lot of what was happening in R&B in the early 90s, too. So it's not too closely pegged to any one era. And it's just a great love song. It's very immediate. You know, you kind of get it the first time that you hear it, and it's had a few sort of high-profile renewals throughout its life. About 10 years ago, Richard Curtis used it in his movie Love Actually in a memorable sequence. So it's had a few little blips like that where it's been able to introduce itself to a new audience.
Well, I did, Chris, look at Billboard's holiday chart and found that Mariah's song was number one last week, but not this week. Pentatonix's Little Drummer Boy now holds the top spot. So has the torch been passed to yet another reworking of an old favorite?
I don't think it's been passed because, of course, Little Drummer Boy is a standard, right? And, you know, my piece was really about the dearth of original new songs, you know, entering the canon. And that one particularly, I have to say, Little Drummer, there are so many Christmas standards that I love. I've yet to hear a version of that one that works for me. Even Mary J. Blige on her new Christmas record can't quite save that one. Just my opinion.
All right, so let's just hear a little bit of the number one, Pentatonix. You can plug your ears for this bit if you want to, Chris.
They told me, ba-ra-ba-ba-ba. A newborn king to see, ba-ra-ba-ba-ba. Our finest gifts we bring, ba-ra-ba-ba-ba.
Okay, we're back. Now, you mentioned Mary J. Blige. Merry Christmas, M-A-R-Y Christmas is the name of her 2013 release. Any other 2013 releases that stick out for you for better or for worse?
Well, two that I really like are Kelly Clarkson's Wrapped in Red and Leona Lewis's Christmas with Love. I mean, those are both pretty clearly trying to sort of replicate the kind of success that the Mariah Carey Christmas album had. You know, where they very self-consciously evoke that kind of Phil Spector-y sound from A Christmas Gift for You with Darlene Love and, you know, The Crystals and all those groups on it from 1963. And they're You know, there's some clear attempt made to kind of evoke the sound of that record. But the thing that I really love about the Clarkson and Leona Lewis records is they do contain some original songs. And a lot of them are worthy. There's a new one on the Kelly Clarkson album called Under the Tree that I like a lot. And the same with Leona Lewis. There's one, there's a song on there called One More Sleep that I really like. So I really appreciate that they're trying to contribute something new to that, what often seems like a very, very short list of perennial Christmas songs.
Let's listen to Kelly Clarkson's Underneath the Tree. This is from the new Christmas album, Wrapped in Red. Got it right, Kelly Clarkson's Underneath the Tree. Yep, we hear the wall of sound right there. It's something
else.
Yeah,
it feels like, I mean, I wasn't around then, you probably weren't either, but now we can visit the early 60s.
Yeah, our beehives were growing even as it was happening. The pattern is for the big acts to put together a bunch of standards and then trot out a new one, right? What about these original Christmas songs? Some of the biggest acts attempt them but always seem to flop. Any notable flops in your mind?
I think Lady Gaga's Christmas Tree from 2008 is pretty terrible. Apologies, Lady Gaga fans. Coldplay, they had a song called Christmas Lights in, I want to say, 2010. Also pretty bad, but I credit them for, actually writing an original Christmas song and making the attempt to contribute something new when it would have been much easier for them to do, say, Happy Christmas, War is Over by John Lennon. So swings and misses, but I appreciate the swings.
You point to the iTunes YouTube culture as being part of the reason, anyway, for the lack of original Christmas songs. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's just a theory that I've kind of floated out there. But, for example, if Justin Bieber had released his album Mistletoe in, let's say, 1971 instead of 2011, if you wanted to hear Justin Bieber do Silent Night, you'd buy the album to get that track, and he still gets a songwriting credit and royalty for the original songs on that album. And now that we're, more and more just cherry-picking the tracks that we want, there may be less incentive for songwriters to expend that energy trying to come up with with a new original Christmas song, especially when they look at the last 19 years and see that most of them disappear quickly. So that's just one theory that I've concocted that may explain it.
Ho! It's another Christmas song. Whoa! Get ready, brother, for another Christmas song.
You can read Chris Klimek's article, All I Want for Christmas is a New Christmas Song, and hear some of those that he talked about. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.
Santa Claus singing on naughty snow, reindeer ringing in the mistletoe, the manger's on fire, the holly's aglow, hear the baby Jesus crying, ho, 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 hey, it's another Christmas song.
Whether scoping out plasma screen HD TVs or picking up a PlayStation 4, consumers upgrading their entertainment systems this Christmas are generally looking for products promising a better picture, superior sound, or next-generation graphics. We have come a very long way since the VHS and the Atari 2600. So far, in fact, that one may wonder how much better the visuals and the sounds and graphics on entertainment systems can get. And would the casual user even be able to tell the difference? With me to talk about where entertainment technology can go from here is Jamin Warren. He's founder and editor-in-chief at Killscreen. That's a video, arts, and culture magazine. Great to have you back with us, Jamin.
Nice to see you too, or to hear you anyway.
Also with us, Slate columnist Carl Wilson. Hello, Carl.
Hi, Virginia.
And David Ewalt, a returning guest, senior editor at Forms. Great to have you back with us, David.
It's nice to be here.
Now, David, I'm going to start with you. If you are watching a Blu-ray disc or a liquid plasma television, you could pretty much see every pore on an actor's face, which, I don't know, can be kind of unsettling. Can home entertainment visuals really look much better than this?
Well, I think we're certainly getting to a point where we're polishing an already shiny spoon to an ever brighter and brighter sheen. But you can make improvements. I mean, when we look at things like plasma TVs and LCD TVs, manufacturers right now are talking about 4K TVs, which, you know, it's four times the resolution of today's 1080p screens. So they are going to get better. You are going to see higher definition. But, you know, we kind of reached a point where things are great and they're just going to get slightly more great.
I'm wondering if the technology can actually jump ahead of how watchers or viewers perceive things. I'm remembering Peter Jackson's first Hobbit film. It was about this time last year. Now, do you remember this? It was filmed in a special high frame rate. Afterwards, mm-hmm. a lot of people said they just preferred the old-fashioned version. Now, what was going on there?
Well, and a lot of people said when they watched the high frame rate film that it actually made them nauseous or gave them headaches. I think some of that is genuine, that, you know, new technologies are going to, people are going to react to them in different ways sort of physically. But also there's always going to be a little bit of just sort of fear and uncertainty about, well, I don't know if I like this new thing. I always think of the story, it may be apocryphal, but there's the story about one of the very first motion pictures. And there's a famous film of a train driving directly towards the film camera. And the story is that the people in the theater watching that first motion picture, when they saw the train driving towards them, they freaked out and they ran out of the theater because they thought it was going to come bursting through the screen. And I think it's just, you always run into something like that when people talk about new technology. People are just unready for it and it's unfamiliar.
Well, Jamin, technology is usually embraced by those video game users. Two new consoles now on the market, the Xbox One and the PlayStation 4. Video game graphics have come so far. Are the graphics provided by these two consoles really that much better than their predecessors?
Well, I guess that depends on who you ultimately ask. I mean, for folks who've been sort of following games for quite some time, graphics have been the one way that consoles traditionally have differentiated themselves. So harking back to the Sega Genesis, you know, Super Nintendo days, there was this big competition about who could do things. And you see that, you know, publishers and game makers, they trot out these terms like blast processing and Mode 7 technology. So graphics has always been this kind of like sleight of hand, a way for game makers to sort of at least convince the going public that something is ostensibly better, more future forward. And for, you know, for quite some time, it was very easy to tell a difference from one generation to another. So the difference in graphics going from 2D to 3D, for example, very, very noticeable difference. Mm-hmm. But now we've kind of reached this point where a lot of the things that are happening in the world of high resolution graphics aren't things necessarily that people might notice. So that might be things like pupils that dilate when they go into sunlight, for example, or blades of grass rustling. These are all things that I think are excellent from a technical standpoint, but for most everyday consumers, they're probably not going to notice the difference. And I think in some ways, graphics have been a distraction for game makers, that it's very expensive to, you know, sort of create each additional layer of, you know, cinematic realism. And ultimately, you know, if you look at the progression of, you know, art over the night from the 19th to 20th century, once photography was discovered, all of a sudden realism and painting was not nearly as important. And so my hope, I think, for games and for the gaming public is that, you know, as we sort of approach this place where things are becoming so incredibly realistic, this is an opportunity to take a step back and look at all the other ways that games can express themselves in new ways and new forms.
Carl Wilson over at Slate Music. When the MP3 first took off, audiophiles decried these digital formats were going to be lower quality, no way to keep your music. Do you think the average consumer really cares about the difference between an MP3 or an MP4A or a CD?
I don't think so. I mean, certainly there are people who are still audiophiles in one way or another and concern themselves with that, but I think for everyone else, the convenience has become the biggest question. You know, music sort of had its high-end, high-tech period during the sort of hi-fi 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. and then again in the CD era starting in the 90s, there was another focus on sound quality, but now it's kind of all about portability and how much you can store on a device that you're taking with you, and also about mutability, about being able to take the files and do things with them on your own and being able to remix and change them. And most of those things don't have too much to do with sound quality. And on one hand, that's a good thing because, you know, during when you think of sort of hi-fi music, where that ended up leading us with when people were obsessed with fidelity and stereo separation was kind of into the prog rock gray zone, you know, where listening to the dynamics and the colors on your headphones was kind of a focus, and that actually affected how music was made, mm-hmm. and there ended up being sort of a backlash against that, kind of a back-to-basics thing in punk that was partly against exactly that kind of hi-fi mode of listening. But on the other hand, the problem you have with MP3s is that you get really narrow bands sonically, so that music has become more compressed. Everything's kind of louder, and you kind of lose the dynamics. It's harder for there to be a really colorful sense of highs and lows in the same way. And so, you know, there's something that's lost, but I think that mostly people are concentrated on what's been gained in the MP3 era.
Okay, so you each have 30 seconds for our last question. Hypothetically speaking, if picture or sound quality could not get any better, what then will product developers and marketers focus on? What's the sales pitch of the future for televisions and video game consoles and digital music? David?
I think we're already seeing a little bit of that future. If you look at the way people are selling TVs and video game consoles right now, they talk about graphics, but the people who make TVs are selling the TVs by saying, this is a smart TV, it connects to the internet, it has apps, it connects to Netflix, you can Skype with your friends and Twitter them. Microsoft, in selling the new Xbox One, sure, they talk about that it plays games, but more than anything, they're really promoting this thing connects to your TV. You can watch your shows. You can hang out with your friends. And I think that's the focus of future marketing.
How about you, Jamin?
Well, it's my sincere hope that we move to maybe my other more esoteric categories. So perhaps like smell or weight, you know, those are things that I think the really discerning video game player should be considering when purchasing their new consoles.
How about for you, Carl? I'm not sure that smell of music is what I'm looking for, but any ideas?
No, I think that it's true that sort of connectivity and interactivity is one of the things that people will be looking at in the future. But I think it's also this sort of ever more intimate experience. You know, the future of a music player is sort of ideally that you'll just think of a song and it'll start playing in your head, right? So the closer we can get to that ideal.
That was Carl Wilson. He is Slate music columnist. Thank you for being with us. And David Ewald, senior editor at Forbes, Jamin Warren, founder and editor-in-chief at Killscreen. Thank you all for being with us today.
Thanks so much.
Now, you
Thank
can
you.
Find more on the Hobbit high frame rate debacle. Watch Jamin's PBS Digital short on whether graphics really matter and look at more related to where we're going technologically in music, video games, and television and films. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. This week, we're shining a spotlight on some of New Hampshire's most kind-hearted souls, the volunteers who give freely of their time and talents to the community, not just at Christmas time, but all year round. We've heard from volunteer tax filers, emergency responders, and today, we're going to hear from a volunteer who, for the last 9 years, has dedicated himself to helping animals in shelters all around New Hampshire.
Hi, Lily. Hello, sweetheart. This is a super sweet dog. My name is Steven Roberto, and I do cat care, dog care. I'm pretty much a jack of all trades, master of nothing. And I'm a volunteer up at the Friends of Manchester Animal Shelter.
Want shit? Want shit for me? Oh, you got no shit for me. You got no shit. Oh, there's a good girl.
I've always, always, always wanted to work with animals. I have had animals since I was knee-high to a grasshopper, and I was able to retire about 11 years ago. Yeah. Not because I wanted to. I hurt my back. I got 5 crushed discs in my back, that type deal. So I went on Social Security disability, and I'm on VA disability because I was in the service. Stay home a lot. You start to go a little crazy, start get a little anxiety, depression. So for me, it became more of a physical therapy. And it's funny just how life turns around, because that's what I've always wanted to do my entire life. Well, let me go volunteer at an animal shelter. And I've been here since.
It's so cute.
Oh,
it's so cute. God. Let me see you. Oh, yeah, a little porker. Oh, my goodness. Look at the little porker.
It's a different environment. It's a total different environment. Everybody thinks it's, oh, you volunteer at a shelter? Oh, you must have a ball playing with the cats and play with it. When I get a chance, yeah, I'll interact with them. But most of the time, I'm cleaning pool, throw up, or doing something
that's not related to socialization. Hey, Trouble. Hi, Trouble. Huh? What? This cat's probably five, six weeks. You got poop on your feet. You've been stepping in poop. You've been stepping in poop. Oh, my goodness. It's so cute. I placed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cats. Hundreds in 8 years. My return rate is minute.
What does it feel like when you get a cat adopted?
That's exactly it. That's the thrill for me, to watch that animal go out that door and knowing that I had a part in it by finding a match for that person. So I made that person happy, I made the cat happy, and I made myself happy. You're a love bug. You're just a love bug. You're pretty brave. You're pretty brave.
Thanks to producer Zach Nugent for that audio postcard, and thanks to volunteer Stephen Roberto and the Friends of Manchester Animal Shelter for their help with the story. Stay with us for more Word of Mouth right after the break here on NHPR. We heard earlier that Christmas songs can quickly puncture the spirit of the season with deep rancor. NHBR's Sean Hurley found this out for himself when he decided to compose a new Christmas carol. Sean brought his song, the Christmas La La Song, to Sirius XM's shock jocks Opie and Anthony for an audition. We'll let Sean pick it up from there. And a reminder that these are the kind of radio personalities that do love to inflame.
In 2006, I started doing a storytelling podcast called Adam's Motion and the Void.
Generally, when I have the urge to walk, it is directly away from the cop.
I mixed together stories I'd written with music that I liked. I didn't use my own voice, but that of an alter ego, who I called Sherwin Sleeves.
You mean this isn't your voice?
Well, it's a voice that I do, but it's an imaginary voice.
Disturbing.
I created a website and posted a few episodes, but then I couldn't figure out how to get anyone to listen to them.
No one listened. No one cared.
At the same time, I was listening to a daily comedy show on XM Satellite Radio.
Buddies, it's the Ron Fez Show, 866.
The host, Ron Bennington, had fast become a kind of radio hero to me. He was street smart and brilliant, and no matter how cutting he was, he couldn't hide the fact that he had a huge heart. Bennington also played songs his listeners sent in. He'd plug their websites, if they had them, as a kind of payment. So I thought I could bring two birds to life with one stone. I could support a show I loved while grabbing a little attention for my podcast. So I started sending in ridiculous songs.
Ladies and gentlemen of the American phenomenon, like puppets in the Sesame Street, with big phenomenon.
Professor Bunsen, I presume. Of the world-class Ogilvies. There's nothing left to ruin here at Muppet University. Oh,
here's my... In November of 2008, Bennington asked me to write a Christmas song. I tried, hard, but the subject was so done and so burnt to a saccharine crisp, I was finding it impossible. I was literally revolting myself with the songs I was coming up with. But then, while working on another song, I stumbled across a little melody that seemed promising. I worked it up into a song and sent it off. Ron played it, and that's where the trouble began. Ron and Fez shared their channel on satellite radio with the infamous shock radio duo, Opie and Anthony. Opie heard the song on the Ron and Fez show and decided to play it on his show.
They played a song by Sleeves. Have you heard his song yet? Sleeves did a song called Christmas Song. And I can't get this damn thing out of my head.
I was feeling pretty good for la 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 la. Taking my time on the la 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 la.
Opie loved it. But Anthony?
That sucked so bad. Dude. I'm being completely honest with you. I'm not even doing this for a bit.
Right.
I hate it.
Then they went to the phones. Bonnie in D.C. liked it.
It actually made me choke up, almost cry in my car. Loved it.
But Melissa in Jersey? Not so much.
Hey, Anthony, I gotta agree with you. That song is absolutely horrendous.
Thank you.
Never heard a song as bad as that.
I gotta tell you, the phones, every single one is lit. Half of them love it, and the other half hate it. I mean, it's right down the middle.
I didn't know it at the time, but I had created the musical equivalent of Elf on a Shelf. And it didn't end there. Christmas, 2009.
Maybe we should play some Sleeves. Oh, no! I think it's time for a little Christmas song from Sleeves.
I haven't heard that in so long, and I hate
Ew.
It. Remember that
Come on,
one?
Let's try it again this
Remember
year.
Remember that
one? Opie still loved it. The callers loved and hated it. And Anthony?
That sucks.
That rules. Sleeves.
God damn.
I'm sorry.
No.
Why? Too much emotion going on?
No, it has nothing to do with emotion. It's I was feeling pretty good in the la 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 la.
Yeah.
What's a la 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 la?
The Christmas.
If he came up in a half place,
Christmas season.
I was feeling pretty good, sitting in my house, and then he's got to rhyme something.
See, that's it. Why didn't you rhyme something?
Well, I was just a singer. You were the lyricist.
Oh, that's true. Why didn't I rhyme something? Anyway, they played it the next year.
What's a la 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 la?
Why is it not?
It's got to mean something.
It's the season in general.
No.
And the year after that.
Stick it through the window and a la 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 la. An empty boat and a la 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 la.
Year after year.
Oh, shut up. I can't take it anymore. God. I enjoyed being told my father was dead more than this. You're doing the sound of that.
What is wrong with
this? This is horrible.
It's not horrible. Sit out
on the pier. Terrible.
It's really not.
Stinks. Look across the bay. It's snowing, you dummy.
That's why it's cool.
Go inside. I hate this guy.
I worried early on that Anthony's contempt would mean that soon no one would like the song. Not that he could brainwash anyone into agreeing with him, but that maybe that innocent moment where you get to decide things for yourself was being blown to bits. But that's not what happened. And over the last 5 years, in a very small way, I got to see how people are strong like that. Like the Who's down in Whoville. Like the people who love Elf on a Shelf, no matter what. It might not be a good song. It might even be an awful song. But it's just an elf on a shelf. And it means whatever you want it to mean. Just like the La 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 La's. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
And I am Sherwin Sleeves. I like to drink a little beer at the end of the day. And go walking in the town, feel like a million miles away. Not as snow as like a sea, like a sand above the beach.
There's a lot of pressure on a wedding photographer. After all the expense and attention to planning the day, the photographer is charged with capturing the fleeting expressions, the flattering angles, the happy guests, and making images that reinforce the indisputable rightness of a couple's decision to unite. But it's just the beginning of a union. Only when the guests have gone home and the camera's been put away does a marriage begin in earnest. Matt Mendelson is a writer and professional photographer of more than 450 weddings since 1999. He explores the meaning of marriage by reconnecting with five couples whose weddings he photographed years before to find out whether their relationships have grown, evolved, or ended. He wrote about the experience in a long-form article for The Washingtonian. And Matt, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, your article, you say that you're less interested in wedding photography as you are by wedding anthropology. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, before I was a wedding photographer or during the early days, I was a journalist. And I don't know, I've always wanted to take a look sort of beyond the normal puffery of weddings and all things bridal. And I think the journalist in me always wanted to sort of go beyond that, you know, silliness, what I always refer to as the your dayness. Everything is, oh, it's your day, all these bridal magazines telling couples and specifically brides that it's all about, you know, one day. And I just thought, wouldn't it be interesting if you actually sort of went a little deeper than that?
Yeah, you did write a really searching piece on going back and finding these couples that you had photographed years before. First, what were you looking to find, do you think?
I don't know. You know, it started in a bizarre way. It started years ago. I went outside to get the Washington Post, and there was a headline in the Metro section that read, "Prominent Bethesda physician, comma, wife, arrested in DEA drug raid." And I looked at the mugshot that went with the story, and I said to my wife, "Oh my God, I shot their wedding." And at that point, I knew there was something, you know, interesting. It sort of planted a seed in my head. And then just a couple of weeks after that, I went to the hospital near my house to photograph Kat Valcourt and her new baby. I had shot her wedding back in 2001. And I photographed her first pregnancy and then her, you know, the happy delivery and all of that stuff. And then I photographed her second pregnancy. But when I went to the hospital to shoot Larry and Kat with the new baby, the baby had already been whisked to Children's Hospital. Mm-hmm. And so Kat was sitting there in a hospital bed by herself. And I said, you know, "Kat, is there anything I can do?" And she said, "Would you mind running this breast milk over to Children's Hospital?" And so I got a little vial and they put it in a cooler for me. And it was early on a weekend morning. And I was stopped at a red light and I looked at the vial of breast milk and I sort of laughed to myself. I mean, not laughing at the seriousness of the situation, but I just thought, what wedding photographer is ferrying vials of breast milk 10 years after the wedding? And so coupled with the other thing, at that point, I knew there was a story to be told.
Kat and Larry, whose wedding you photographed back in 2001, have had a pretty rough time of it in some respects, but yet have one of the strongest marriages of any of the couples you interviewed. Any observations or connections there?
You know, when I was writing this story, as a writer, you have a tendency to sort of pre-compartmentalize, meaning you think, and this couple is going to be the happy story, and this is going to be the divorce story, and this is going to be the depressing story. You know, you just sort of do that as you lay it out in an outline. So there's a tendency to think that Kat and Larry would be the sad story. They have a child with a very rare genetic disorder or the genetic deletion. And so there's a tendency to think that they were going to be the sad story. And yet Kat is really one of the most joyous people I know. So I guess, you know, the obvious moral to the story is you just can never tell. If you would look at another couple, you know, Stuart and Stephanie were a beautiful couple. And because maybe it's just you just make these kind of assumptions, but I would have said, oh, they're going to be a beautiful, happy marriage. But instead, their marriage has sort of ended in a very bitter divorce. So you just never know.
I saw some of the photographs of Stephanie and Stuart absolutely glowing in their wedding portrait from 1999. You did photograph them again for this story. The difference is really striking. Can you tell us how you think things devolved for this couple?
There's a great little anecdote that I used in the story that is really telling. And it's so they were married in 1999. And then in 2008, I believe, Stuart suffered a brain aneurysm, and he was rushed to Washington Hospital Center. In the days that followed, he was conscious. They were prepping. They had to do a marathon surgery. And they were prepping for the surgery, and they were going through a routine pre-op, you know, a list of pre-op questions. And the doctor said, "Do you drink?" And he said, "No." And they said, "Do you do drugs?" And they said, "No." They said, "Do you smoke?" And he said, "You know, a pack a day." And Stephanie looked over at me when she was relating the story, and she said, "I had no idea." Mm. And I said, "Oh, come on, Stephanie, how could you not know that your husband smoked? I mean, you know, his clothes must have." And she said, "No, I really didn't have any idea that he was smoking that much or smoking at all." It was just a little thing, but it sort of foretold the beginning of the end. I mean, it wasn't necessarily the brain surgery, but it was the questions before the brain surgery that sort of clued them in that perhaps they just didn't know each other as well as they thought they knew each other. Mm. And this is after years and years of marriage.
And Stuart did actually survive after
the
surgery.
He did survive. He did.
But I guess the photographs that you'd made of them for the wedding was one of the casualties of this divorce.
Stuart and Stephanie, to their credit, were very kind to me in that both of them communicated to me throughout their ongoing separation and divorce proceedings. But at one point, Stephanie, right before the story was going to press, Stephanie emailed and said that Stuart, sort of in a fit of rage, had gone into their house and broken all the framed wedding pictures that I had taken back in 1999. You know, you, as a photographer, you have a sort of a gut reaction to that, which is, no, not my photographs. And then, of course, you realize that's sort of way down on the priority list. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to have to email Stuart and awkwardly ask him why he did it. And he said, you know what, I just couldn't look at them anymore. I just couldn't look at those pictures on my wall. And so, yeah, I broke them. And he apologized to me. He said, I'm sorry. I know they were your pictures. And I was like, oh, don't worry about it. But it was, you know, you realize that as a photographer, you're documenting, you know, these moments in lives, and those lives will change drastically from day one, the your day moment.
Matt Mendelsohn is with us. He's a writer. He's a professional photographer. He's photographed hundreds of weddings. And he went back and visited with five couples whose weddings he had photographed years before to find out what happened to them. As we're hearing, the changes are both unpredictable and bittersweet human experiences.
Exactly.
One of the couples that you photographed never actually got legally married after the ceremony. Courtney and Stefan, and by the way, all of these names have been changed for anonymity. Tell us about this couple. What happened with them?
Well, they were married, and Courtney's mom long ago came out as a gay person, and she said that on their wedding day, her mom's gay friends joked with her, oh, you know you're marrying a gay man, don't you? And she said, oh, please, you know, he just, you know, dresses very neatly. She just said to me, I just can't believe I missed all of these warning signs. I mean, she said that they were not having intimate relations, and they were, you know, as she got deeper into their marriage, she realized something was amiss, and it became very clear what the amiss part was, and things went downhill from there.
I have a friend who was a couples therapist for a long time who said that she could tell pretty much in the first visit whether or not this couple was going to make it. Do you ever speculate about a couple's chances for a lasting marriage when you photograph their wedding?
I mean, I think we all do. I think not just the photographer, but every person who is a guest at the wedding is secretly doing the same thing.
Laying odds?
Yeah, not as a blood sport, but just sort of in the back of your mind, you wonder. I sort of giggle because I have a lot of Facebook friends who are fellow photographers, fellow wedding photographers. And so every Saturday, I see a stream of Facebook posts that say something to the effect of, so honored to be shooting John and Stacy's wedding today. And I always say to myself, why are you honored? You don't really know them at all. You don't really know your clients, and you don't know whether they're going to be divorced or, you know, end up in a DEA drug raid, as one of my clients did, or dying. It's kind of like shooting the coin flip before a football game and leaving and thinking, ah, I've got enough. Well, that's just the coin flip. The game hasn't actually started yet. And so to make all these assumptions based on a one-hour meeting in your studio and a one-day wedding, you know, you're bound to be wrong. I guess what the story was meant to do is to make people realize that you go in, let's say I go into a wedding and I shoot 5,000 frames, and those frames get edited down to 1,500 that the couple will see. And of those 1,500, they might choose 60 for a wedding album. And of those 60, one or two of them actually gets printed out and stuck into a 5x7 frame. That one picture out of that original 5,000 will really be the only one that stands the test of time, and that will be handed down over the years and left in an attic box and found by great-grandchildren. So for all of these thousands of pictures we as photographers take, it really becomes one image that will last 100 years or 200 years if we're all lucky. But, you know, I don't know.
Matt Mendelsohn, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Matt Mendelsohn, a writer, a professional photographer, and you can find a link to read his article for The Washingtonian. It's a terrific long-form piece called The Remains of the Day, and also see a slideshow of some of his photographs. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Bill Berry,
and Zach Nugent.
Our intern is
James Pouliot.
Digital support from Rebecca Lavoie
and Sarah Plord.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org. You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth
is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.